Alpha Vaughn interview for March 20th, 2005. Testing, testing, 1, 2, 3. Hi, Mr. Vaughn. This is Anthony Young. I'm calling from Miami, Florida.
I have started
a book on the history of the lunar rover.
Ron Creel sent me a note on that today.
Good. I'm glad you got that. He's been very helpful to me. And I had spoken with him that I wanted to... I've seen your name in print in a number of publications, especially the technical report that Ron has put up on the internet. You're mentioned among the principal contributors to that.
Well, I did a lot of work in the design characteristics of the lunar soil and adaptability studies of
my... Okay. I was wondering, would you be available to speak today, or would you like me to call back to set up a good, convenient time?
Well, I could talk to you now if you want to.
Oh, that'd be terrific. Actually, this...
were you coming up? I thought you were coming up here.
Yes, as a matter of fact, I am.
But I'm
assuming a lot of my time is going to be spent at the University of Huntsville and their archives.
Well, they don't have a lot of stuff on Rover over there.
Oh, is that right?
No, I mean, they have some, but not a lot.
Okay.
There's a lot of stuff they don't have, I'm sure.
Well, I'm sure you'll be attending the lunar buggy.
Well, I might be working that day in the museum, so I can come out.
Oh, okay, that's terrific. Let me briefly give you some background. I did an article that was published last year for Automobile Quarterly magazine on the lunar rover design. And at that time, I had very little time to actually interview all the people I wanted, but I did get to interview three of the principal astronauts, John Young, Charlie Duke, and Gene Cernan.
Yeah.
And of course, I did interview Mr. Maria. But I have seen your name in print, and I was hoping to interview you because I'm trying to get together all the principal engineers who worked on the program, at least the ones who can speak with me. So what I wanted to do first is to find out from you where you and when you got started at Marshall Space Flight Center.
I came to Huntsville in 1956.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
And I worked with the Von Braun team, the Army Ballistic Missile Agency.
Okay, yes.
Until 1960.
Mm-hmm.
Then we transferred into NASA in 1960 with the Marshall Space Flight Center.
Yes, it did become that then.
Until July the 1st.
Well, I understand from my principal research that actually lunar vehicle research was taking place at Marshall all through the 60s before the main program got started. In terms of vehicle design...
We did a lot of work in Marshall. They did some early work back in the 57 era on lunar mobility, but not very much. We developed a lunar base for the Army.
Oh, I see.
It was called Project Horizon.
Yes, I'm sorry, go ahead.
It's called Project Horizon. That's what the Army called it.
I see, so...
And it's mainly to talk about how to build a lunar base.
I see.
Because, you know, the Army always talks about the high ground.
That's right.
And if you hold the high ground, you hold the area.
Okay, well,
so that was the idea of going to the moon, basically, with a lunar base.
I see. I was unaware of that. Okay.
To make observations of the Earth from the lunar base.
So it was this program, what was the name of the program again, I'm sorry?
Project Horizon.
Project Horizon. And this included not just a base itself, but means of getting around on the moon, correct?
Well, you know, at that stage of the game, we were just talking about, let's build a base on the moon, and then, they really didn't have a lot of mobility.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm just trying to remember some of the things that was in, and it's mainly just building the base itself. There was building a vehicle to get to the moon, to carry all the equipment needed to go to the moon, this kind of thing.
I see, okay.
And,
When do you feel there was a shift toward the actual program? When there was serious interest in, obviously when Apollo started, but...
The history goes back to Herbert Oberth. Homer Everett did a lot of work in the about writing about going to the moon.
Mm-hmm.
And yet he had a concept for a vehicle that could go on the moon.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And I can't think exactly what the name it was called, but I think it's mentioned in that book that Mitch Sharp. I think on the website there, on Ron's website,
mm-hmm.
or somewhere, there's a mention about a locomotion on the moon or something like that.
Yes.
And in that, it talks about this a vehicle that Obot had. It was a very big thing. It's a very large thing. It was just a concept.
Yes.
And you can find something on that in some of Von Braun's writings.
I see, yes. Okay.
But we really didn't get started on the rover until probably about 60, I'm trying to think, 63, I guess it was, somewhere along there.
See, so it was
I'd
that
have
early.
To go back to recall this stuff, you know what I mean?
Yes.
But we were doing, Marshall was doing some small in-house work, a lot of in-house work on developing some kind of a mobility system. Because
mm-hmm.
I remember that Von Braun told one of the astronauts at one time, he said, by the time you get to the moon, we'll probably have some kind of mobility for you.
Yes, I think I know what story you're talking about. I think Gene Cernan mentioned that.
Yeah.
Okay. When did you...
Mitch Sharp and a lady by Burkett, I think it was, Mitch Sharp, and, mm-hmm. They actually wrote a document about the rover.
Oh, I see. Okay. All right.
It's just almost like a paperback, though. It's not a hard copy.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And it was some kind of presentation at, I think, some kind of International Astronomical Union or something like that.
Oh, okay. All right. I'm making a note of that.
But yeah, we had some small vehicles here at Marshall that we built, like a four-wheel little job. And we had some very, very large vehicles we had built here at Marshall to talk about going to the moon. And that was called the Apollo Exploration Program.
Mm-hmm.
And Bendix Company was one company, General Motors was one company, and Grumman was one company.
Yes.
And that was all during the early 60s.
I see. Okay. Because I'm trying to get the I've seen pictures of these various vehicles, and I was trying to get a timeline when these were going on.
Well, I've got some pictures of the vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
Myself.
Okay.
I can show those to you.
Okay, well, I'm sure...
When you get up here.
Yeah, I'll be going up there on Thursday of that week.
Yeah, well, you said you're supposed to come up on Thursday, probably be there for a while.
Okay.
Yeah. Jim Sissom is the other guy that was a project manager after Jim was one that actually followed 17 more than anything else.
Oh, I see. What you said, Simpson?
Huh?
What's his
Sissom was his name?
Oh, Sissom. Yes.
Yeah. Ron mentioned him in that email to me.
Okay. Yes.
But, I think he said. Well, you've got the email also.
Yes, I'm sure he copied me on that.
Yeah. And I believe he's living in Scottsboro now, but I'm not sure. He may be in Huntsville, but I'm not sure where he is.
Okay. All right. Well, maybe we can discuss then when this program was finally approved, the Lunar Rover Task Group.
Yeah.
Were you involved in the creation of the request for proposal?
My documentation, my criteria information, I wrote a couple of documents which were used for the design characteristics of the lunar surface and soil characteristics and the roughness and crater distribution and stuff like that. And I had a bunch of documents there that were appendix to the actual request for proposals.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And then also I was the chairman of the lunar surface design committee for the we wrote a couple of monographs for NASA on the lunar surface.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And those are SPs. And also in 1967 proposed a lunar mission to go to the moon, to go to a surveyor site, and to bring back parts of the surveyor. And that was in 67. I proposed that.
And they actually did that.
And they finally did it. But I didn't say go to the particular site. They went to an Apollo 12, but I told them to go to a surveyor site, which they could get to.
Okay.
And then hikes outlined the very things that they should do at that site. Mm-hmm. And then lo and behold, they did it on Apollo 12.
Yes, they did. That was very gratifying, I'm sure.
Well, I never got mentioned.
Oh. Well, that won't happen.
Somebody at NASA headquarters said they came up with the idea.
Oh, not invented here.
But the funny part about it was I got a document that shows I did it in 67.
Okay. Well,
anyway, you know how that goes.
So sure, I'm a firm believer in giving credit where credit's due. And,
well, yeah, I'm sort of irritating me a little bit on that one, but that's all right.
Well, I know as I complete, I'm devoting an entire chapter on engineering of the LRV, then a chapter to training, then three individual chapters for each of the Apollo missions, and then I have some subsequent chapters on the Martian rovers.
Oh, I see. Okay. The lunar rover, we started out what we call a model called ELMO, E-L-M-O. That was what it was called.
I see.
Or ELMS, I think you call it ELMS, E-L-M-S or something like that, was our member. And it was strictly just a statistical, just a model to give some idea of roughness of how we might design a vehicle. And that's where we did some early design work with that model. And I thought it got selected to go ahead and see if I couldn't come up with a good surface model.
I see.
And so I began working on that, and we tried to use as much information as we could find. You know, the radar data, the thermal data, the photometric function data, and then just plain old surface roughness data. In other words, how rough was the lunar surface in terms of mobility? So we went back to look at the Army Waterways Experiment Station down in Mississippi had done an awful lot of work on off-the-road vehicle mobility.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of our starting point for that. And we used that kind of data, and then we came up with what we called a good ground clearance model and a model which gave some ideas so they could get some idea of the surface roughness on it. And then we actually built a lunar driving simulator here at Marshall and drove the astronauts. They drove our simulator on the moon here, and we developed that hand controller for the lunar rover.
Yes, I know John Young was talking to me about that because of the stiffness.
Well, John did a lot of work in that.
Yes, because of the stiffness of the gloves, especially under pressure.
Yeah, that was part of the problem with gloves and the fact that you couldn't do very much maneuvering with the hands, you know, and so we tried to go with some kind of concept of simple wheel, a simple head controller.
Mm-hmm.
And we had one time possibly a roll bar that we were thinking about putting on the rover because we were afraid they might roll over.
Yes, yes.
But we didn't have enough weight allowance for that, so we took the weight off.
I see.
Then we found that we didn't have any fenders to start with, and then we finally decided, well, based on some of our KC-135 Vomit Comet tests with the rover and the wheel and the lunar dust simulant, that we could see we were going to need fenders. So we came up with the fenders.
Oh, no, because I can you tell
and
me
a little bit? We also did some remote control study with the lunar rover also here at Marshall. We actually drove it around the center from remote control through our own crater field.
Oh, I see. I think I've seen pictures of that, yes. So there were actually tests done on the Vomit Comet with a part of the vehicle, the whole
vehicle? Yeah, they actually did a whole vehicle. We did a whole vehicle, just a platform with four wheels to see how it would respond under 1/6 G and how much it would bounce and things like this.
Okay.
And these were not wire wheels. These were regular rubber tired wheels.
I see.
And well, I think there's a picture. We have a picture of that vehicle somewhere.
Yeah, I understand that quite a bit of work had to go into devising just what the ratio of the actual chevron material to the wire wheel itself, so there wouldn't be slippage, yet there'd be enough support. I guess there was a lot of work involved in the design of the wheel itself.
Yeah, the main thing with that wheel design was that we had three types of wheels at one time, and one of them was just a plain metal wheel with a set of metal springs in it. And looking at trade-off weights and things like that, the wire mesh wheel tended to come out better in the long run, based on the fact that it did give us some flexibility that we could use to help us tune the suspension system.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we went to the wire mesh, plus the fact it was a lunar day operation, so we had to have a material that was suitable to the high temperature lunar day.
Yes. Okay.
And then we also had a We also, you know, went with a four-wheel drive, each wheel separate drive. So in case one wheel went out, we could disengage it and still drive, you know.
Mm-hmm. What I'm finding out, too, is that Marshall, a lot of people have this perception that once Boeing got the contract, really, they did a lot of the work themselves, but I'm finding out that Marshall had to work very closely with Boeing to make sure the vehicle stayed within the parameters. In other words, Marshall had already done a lot of work.
Oh yeah, we did a lot of in-house work. We always did that before, though. See, we in the early 50s, in the late 50s, when we were designing the Redstone and the Jupiter C and the Juno and the Saturn V, we built all those things in-house.
I see. Yeah.
And then finally they got to where we said, well, we need to go out to contractors.
Yeah.
And we started going out to contractors. But we did an awful lot of work in-house. And that's when, you know, finally we built our prototypes in-house, basically. And then if we could get enough money to be any, we'd get the contractor to produce a number of them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's what happened with the Boeing contract. We produced, I think it was four rovers, I believe it was, and a bunch of test hardware and things like that. Sonny can tell you about that because he was a contract manager and that stuff.
Who's that now? The gentleman you mentioned?
Maria.
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah. I have interviewed him, but I'll be interviewing him again to get a bit more information.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this. How close do you feel the Boeing design for the rover was to what Marshall had really already conceived? Because I really don't know the extent of the detail of the request for proposal. How close was the
I think it was pretty close to what we talked about in our design.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what you always have, you have a request for proposals, and they come in with their proposal, and then you have a source selection board, and those people go through that proposal pretty deep.
Mm-hmm.
And try to figure out, well, which contractor could do the best job for the proposal at the cheapest price.
Right.
And so that's what happens. So, I think Boeing came out pretty good with our shape of what we were after. And usually you don't get everything you want because it's sort of impossible to get it. You know, you just have to advise and consent, I'm trying to say.
Yes.
You know, so you work very closely with them.
Well,
And, you know, one time we even had a flying vehicle that we talked about, a small little flyer, which we were going to build, but they backed out on that because they felt it was too dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was reading about that.
The GSC wasn't in favor of that anyway, so that was another factor.
Okay. When the rover was being going through the design and development stage, did they have Boeing people at Marshall? In other words, were there pretty much teams both in the...
Well, I think Boeing was right here in town.
Oh, I see. So they...
Boeing was right here in town, so we could run right down to the big building, they called it at that point, I think it was. And you know, we and they come out to the center. We worked both effects, you know, both ways.
Because everything I've read led me to believe that all the design development was done up in Washington State.
Well, a lot was done in Boeing plant up there, but then they did a lot of work here in Huntsville also.
Okay.
Just like that, you know, Santa Barbara, General Motors in Santa Barbara were the ones that actually built the mobility system. But then a lot of the design for some of the electrical motors were done here at Marshall.
I see.
And then they were modified and improved and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And a guy named Fred Nola here. He was the one that really got some patented stuff on those bunch of motors.
Oh, I see.
Those Harmonic Drive motors, I think they call them.
Yeah, they were only a quarter horsepower each. I was very impressed with that. Fred Nola.
Yeah, Fred Nola, yeah.
Does he live there in Huntsville?
Yeah, but he's not here now. I think he's down in Florida, so I'm not sure where.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm sure I may be able to track him down.
He may be down in St. Petersburg. Or he might have been down there just this winter when I tried to talk to him a few times.
Oh, I see.
I had to send him email, you know.
Okay, yes.
Dr. Costas, Nick Costas, was the one that came up with a good soil model.
I see.
The actual soil model for the lunar surface. He and Dr. Carey out at Johnson Space Center worked very closely on the soil model. Nick was a civil engineer.
Mm-hmm.
And so I worked very close with Nick. Nick and I worked together to try to come up with a composite model of the the characteristics of the soil, plus the number of craters and blocks and debris and things like that. We work closely together.
Did you work use a lot of the photographic data from Surveyor and these sort of things to
get? I got my connection not too good. I'm having a hard time hearing.
Okay. Did you resort to a lot of photography from
Lander? We actually took a lot of the. Every time we get a photograph of the moon, even from Surveyor, we started looking at Surveyor and counting the blocks and looking how much where the craters were and things like that. And I spent many hours looking at photographs trying to come up with what I thought was a good representative lunar scale roughness model. And then I worked very closely with the guys at the Geological Survey at Flagstaff, Arizona, a center of astrogeology out there, to come up with a good surface model. So, you know, it wasn't my model per se. I used a lot of people's model to come up with a model.
I see. Now, what form did these models take in a three-dimensional sense? Did you
Well, basically, they were just, like I said, a series of parameters, like what's the surface roughness, what kind of block distributions you might expect on this, what size the craters you're going to have. From a mobility standpoint, we tried to establish what was the minimum amount of ground clearance we had to have for the rover, how wide it should be to get between the craters, around the craters, what should be the bearing pressure or the pressure of the wheel on the soil.
Yes.
That kind of thing.
I see. Okay.
So we designed it basically from if the LAMP could land with 1 pound per square inch bearing pressure, and it was designed to land on the moon's surface, then we designed our rover with about 1 pound per square inch bearing surface on the moon itself.
I see. Okay.
So the idea being that if you know if the LAMP could land, we're sure the rover could work.
I understand.
But
yeah.
We also noticed that on one of the surveyors that when the surveyor came down, I think it was Surveyor 7 or Surveyor 1. Anyway, she came down and she bounced about 10 feet in the air.
Wow.
On the moon.
I had no idea.
So once it bounced, we felt like we had a pretty good, you know, we knew now we didn't have a real thick, you know, insulating layer of regolith on top of the moon.
Mm-hmm.
Solid, on top of the moon itself, but the surface conditions would be a fairly thin layer and then a fairly hard layer below that in the Maria layer. Maria area. So we felt like we had a pretty good design from that standpoint.
Okay.
And then even before the mission went to the moon, I wrote a letter to Dr. Geiser, my boss, and explained to him what I thought would happen on the moon. And in that letter, just about everything I said came true.
I see.
I copied that letter.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you get to actually, when they were building, did Marshall build any rover prototypes itself, or were these all Boeing?
Well, actually, Brown Engineering built some prototypes for us.
I see.
And then they contracted, I don't know who else, to build some test vehicles. We had each of the contractors, like Boeing and Chrysler, Boeing and Grumman and...
Bendix, I guess.
Bendix. Now, each of us provided us with a very, very large vehicle. Those were called the MOLABs, or the MTA. Mobility test articles.
Yes, yes.
They had big wheels, like 6 foot in diameter, or 7 foot in diameter, big wheels.
I see.
And we were, at that time, we were considering building a 30-day mission rover on the moon.
Oh.
The MOLAB.
Which would have to be pressurized, I guess.
Oh, it wasn't pressurized. It would be a MOLAB completely, and actually, General Motors built one for the United States Geological Survey to play around with that in Flagstaff.
I see.
And we have one of those at Space and Rockets. We had one of those Space and Rockets, and I think we still have it outside.
I see, okay.
It was called a mobile laboratory.
Did you get to drive any of these vehicles?
Well, I did a lot of work on designing of the lunar driving simulator.
Oh, okay.
At Marshall, and I got a chance to drive the simulator and also work with the crews on developing their techniques for driving on the moon.
Because John Young did mention the motion-based simulator at Marshall. Is that what you're referring to?
Did he mention that?
Yeah, he mentioned a motion-based
simulator. Yeah, we had a motion-based simulator at Marshall. See, what we did, we took basically a 707 flight simulator with big hydraulic jacks under the floor of this little platform, and we mounted a completely test-driving station on the platform with a small TV camera and a small little unit which actually moved over a moving-based simulator. A moving base map. And on that map, we could actually take the analog signals from the little sensors that were moving. running across the map, and then we fed those into the computer, and the computer computed the parameters, and they moved the hydraulic systems underneath the rover vehicle test bed we had, and therefore the astronauts got the motion of the vehicle while they're driving it.
Oh, I see. Okay.
They were in the spacesuit also, so it, you know, so it worked out real nice like that.
Okay.
I wrote a paper on that.
Is there any way you, I'm sure these things are long gone, but, you know, if I'm able to get or make any copies of these, they might be helpful
to me.
Yeah,
I've got some copies of that thing.
Okay. Well, I'm sure I'll be able to touch base with you when I come up there.
Yeah, right, yeah.
And I can give you my card, and then perhaps later you can
mail them. Yeah, I can maybe send you some stuff, yeah.
That'd be terrific.
Yeah.
Well, the program itself was a very short duration. There wasn't much time to get all this together. It's pretty unprecedented.
It was about 18 months.
Yes.
As I remember.
Yeah.
But like I said, although it was 18 months in actually building a vehicle, it was probably 5 or 6 years in development.
Well, yeah, that's just it. I think I need to make mention of that because some people think this was, it went from nothing at all to an utterly reliable vehicle in only 18 months, and really there was a lot of groundwork done.
A lot of groundwork. You had a lot of people working on it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The Waterways Experiment Station did an awful lot of work on soil mechanics for us.
I'd like to mention that because it wasn't until I read that paper that I actually even heard of this group.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
and,
is that right?
And obviously they were a very big contributor to the success of the vehicle. Because if the soil samples are wrong, the design will not be correct and the vehicle wouldn't function.
Yeah, well, see, Nick came up after the first Apollo landed. Nick was able to get a lot of information about the actual soil characteristics. And so they came up with what they call the lunar soil simulant.
Mm-hmm.
And then we made tons of that stuff. And then that stuff was shipped down to Waterways Experiment Station, and they had these big vats of soil in which they ran the wheels up and down.
Oh, I see.
To get information on slip and how much climbing capability the vehicle would have, how much power it would take to do it, things like this.
I see, okay.
And these were individual wheels. So there's a number of reports out on that stuff.
Okay. Well, I'm sure that report that Mr. Creel put up on the web has a lot of...
Well, yeah, that the Bible, as he called it, basically, was really one of the many reports.
Mm-hmm.
And we just started summarizing what they found on the missions.
Okay.
And I think that was only written for Apollo 15, I believe it was.
I believe that's correct.
I'm not sure. I know Nick didn't have time to write it for the other one, please.
What do you think was one of the most interesting events for you during this development phase
the most interesting thing to me was when we were actually on the moon and we were working with the crews trying to tell them exactly where they were based on what we thought where they were.
I see.
Based on our navigation system
mm-hmm.
that we had on the vehicle. And that was a problem because, you see, when you're running on the moon with that vehicle and you get a certain amount of wheel slip and you try to measure how far you've gone because of the number of rotations of the wheel.
Yes.
And you get the wheel slip. Then you got to figure out how much wheel slip you really had and where you really are.
Mm-hmm.
So we tried to do a simple technique of using a lot of photographic images of every site that we landed at, every station on the Traverse, and we take photographs of every one of the locations the information on the horizon, and try to identify those on the map, and then try to resection back to where we thought the rover actually was.
I see. Yeah.
So it's just a lot of manual labor.
You didn't have a lunar positioning system, so to speak, like a global positioning system.
Oh, no, it had nothing like that, no.
Yeah,
The problem on the moon, too, the moon has a line of sight only about 1 mile.
Is that all?
Yeah. So
I had no idea.
If you're down low, you can't see hardly anything. And if you get up high, you can see a little bit. Like when they were on top of on some of the slopes on Apollo 17, they could go back and actually see the rover out there
yes.
in the distance.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the criteria we had. You cannot get out of line of sight of the rover, and you cannot get where you cannot walk back to the rover.
Yes, that's
And that's why the rover could not go. We had a lot more capability in the rover than we could utilize, but we didn't get to do it.
Right, sure. If it conked out for any reason, they did have to be able to get back, because the range of the rover was really much greater, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. But our criteria was that they have to have enough oxygen and water supply to be able to walk back.
Mm-hmm.
They had to, in case they got completely immobilized, stuck, or couldn't get out. But we actually put little hand holes on the rover so they could pick it up if they got stuck.
Okay. Let me ask you something, since obviously I won't be able to interview the great man himself. What was, did you have any dealings with Dr. Von Braun, and what was he like to really work with?
What?
With Dr. Von Braun, did you have any direct dealings with him on during the lunar?
Well, he would come down and look at a lot of my lunar photographs I had. See, I use a lot of lunar photographs, like the lunar orbiter.
Yes.
The orbiter, and any kind of orbital photographs we could get, we tried to make some sense out of those.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the time, that stuff was not good resolution. It was like maybe 60 or 70, 100 meter resolution.
Yes.
Whereas the lunar orbiter stuff was 1 meter resolution.
Oh.
And on the lunar orbiter, you could actually see where boulders had come rolling down the hillside.
I see. Mm-hmm.
So, again, we knew we had pretty good soil situations.
Well, that's great. So were you privy to all three Apollo missions using the rover? Were you part of what was the name of the team that was actually in real time in the back room with the
we just called the Lunar Rover Group.
Is that right? Okay.
Yeah, we were the LRV group.
Because I know there was the geologic group. I mean, geologists.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which was a different group altogether. Yeah.
Yeah, well, now most of those people were out of JSC.
Oh, okay. They were up in Houston.
Yeah, they were right there at Johnson Space Center. Most of Marshall people were here at Marshall in our Mission Control Center that support the rover operations per se.
Okay.
Because it was a Marshall vehicle, not a JSC vehicle.
That's correct.
And so we had a lot of trade-offs. We had to work with the geological people on where they wanted to go and how much power we had and how much hot the batteries were and things like that. So we had to make trade-offs real time. We can't go that distance, or we can't go that distance, we'll have to stop and wait for you to do this,
Right, because I've been watching some of the tapes. You may have heard of a company called Spacecraft Films. They've put all the transcript, the film transcripts, onto DVD now. And,
there's a lot of transcripts of it, yeah.
And they actually talk about lifting the covers on the batteries to let them cool off, and that's
it. Yeah.
So,
We had the batteries, I think, were pretty unique in one sense of the word, because we had this wax on top of the batteries, which would liquefy, because when the batteries got warm, they could radiate heat to that wax, and that wax would liquefy, and then once it liquefied, then you could open the top of the covers, and then the wax could look out at deep space and radiate out, and then when she solidified, you could put the covers back down.
Oh, I see, because
so
I saw
that's the way we control the battery temperature. Ron knows more about that. Knows more about that than I do.
Okay, because I saw the illustrations that point out wax boxes, and I go, what's the wax box? Well, now I know.
Yeah.
I understand a little bit better. That's great.
When it liquefies, it absorbs quite a bit of heat.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, you want it to radiate out. That's what you do.
Sure.
And it's a simple system. It works real great.
Well, apparently there were almost no changes necessary to the rover even after the Apollo 15 mission. Is that correct?
Yeah. By the time we got to 16, we had pretty much had a good rover. Yeah.
Okay.
And I think we might have made some cosmetic changes, things like that, but I'm not sure exactly what.
Okay.
But rover, we had to get permission from the rover company to use that name.
Which name?
Rover. The little rover.
Oh, you mean the British company?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. They gave us permission to use the name Rover.
Oh, okay.
as a copyrighted name.
Okay.
For Land Rover, see.
Well, that's a good. That's something I need to look out for myself then, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay. Are there anything else I've been making notes here too, and I can follow up a little bit later, but there are any other instances or occurrences that were significant that you
found? Not off the bat, I think.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you were able to talk with me a little bit about this today. You were focused primarily on the soil situation and how it affected the design of the wheels and, say, suspension.
Yeah, I didn't do the wheel design. No, that was done by other people, but
sure.
Like I said, my job was to come up with the actual ground clearance, the number of craters per unit area,
mm-hmm.
How rough the surface was, so when you got into motion, how they might design a suspension system.
Yes.
That's another reason we went with a wire mesh wheel, because it gave us a certain amount of flexibility that other wheels didn't.
And
it was lightweight also.
That one of the problems I'm finding is trying to find the people who had worked at GM or at Boeing that might be able to talk to me about the Rover. I'm having a particular problem with it. Of course, it's been over 30 years, but are there a couple of names of people that
Sam Romano was sort of in charge in Santa Barbara there.
Yeah.
But then there's Pavlich was another guy. And there was, like I said, I don't remember how many people we had. We had an awful lot. Matter of fact, I think we had almost 800 people at one time working on Rover.
Oh, that's a very interesting fact.
I mean, and that didn't include some of the other contractors, I'm sure.
Wow.
So, you know, you take, I don't know how many people Boeing had to start with, and then as it began to ramp up to produce the four of them,
mm-hmm.
you had more documentation you had to cover, things like that. And
So there were actually four vehicles planned?
Well, there were actually four as well as I remember. Now, Sonny can tell you that. But I know that, you know, we had 15, 16, and 17, and then we had what we call later on a study, which was called the dual-mode rover.
Yes.
Which we never got to build.
I see.
And that was one that we planned to do by remote control.
Okay.
And that's why we got into a bunch of remote control studies at Marshall to try to see how we could remote control this vehicle and operate it.
Mm-hmm.
So we actually built a test vehicle for that and actually had a stereo cameras on it and drove it down the highway there at Marshall, on the roads at Marshall, and drove it into our crater field at Marshall. We actually had a crater field there.
Was this after the primary rover, or was this early?
This was early. And later on we developed this, as we got into the rover design, further design, we came up with this dual mode rover concept.
Okay.
And that was to do the manned and the unmanned and mm-hmm. remote control operation. And then all of a sudden, all the rover work went to JPL.
Oh, yes, that's right. The robotic rover went to JPL. That's true.
We kind of lost out on that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I hope to meet you up there during the moon buggy race.
I'll try to bring some stuff with me, and when we get together, I'll try to have some stuff. I can show you some stuff.
Okay, that's great. I'll be there on Saturday, so I'm sure I'll get to see you.
Okay.
Thanks for talking with me tonight, Mr. Vaughn. I appreciate it.
Take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.